Welcome to Postscript, the podcast where my girlfriend talks about movies and I'm also in the room. I'm David.
And I'm Tori, the girlfriend. This season is about what makes a good or bad act one of a movie. You're probably wondering how we ended up in this situation. Well, it all started with a voiceover.
Perfect.
I wrote a really stupid intro for this one.
I think it's good. I think it works. I think it's funny.
Okay. Okay, so there's a huge burden on Act One to describe what's normal for the universe and what's not normal for the universe of the movie. In a movie like Jurassic Park or The Matrix, that's actually kind of easier because it starts in our world and it follows the rules of our world, and then everything that weird that happens in the world of the movie is also weird for the world of that movie, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So actually at the beginning of The Matrix, when Trinity is jumping between buildings, somebody literally says,
"That's impossible."
That's impossible, which is basically just to tell us, yeah, like, this is not normal in this world either. This is weird in this world too.
Yeah.
Because we wouldn't necessarily know that otherwise.
Yeah. I really like this. I mean, I think this whole setting of the universe is ultimately what really can make an action movie fun.
Like, yeah.
Another example from Die Hard 3, which is, you know, soon going to be obvious that it's one of my favorites.
It's a great one.
I love that movie. One of my favorite examples for that, you know, like, it's an action movie. They do a lot of stuff that a regular human being could not do, but the movie's full of one-liners. The characters are so over the top cool that it creates an environment where it's almost believable, but we still aware that it's in New York because the whole thing was filmed on location with real explosions and stuff like that. And I remember there's one scene when they jump on a boat from the bridge, which is impossible.
Right.
Like, you can't fucking do that. And right before they jump, Sam Jackson just looks at Bruce Willis and said something like, "Well, we need a lot of luck for this," or something like that.
Shit, just gotta take a mirror. Keep your fingers crossed.
He just calls it out.
He
takes a note that even in that universe,
yeah,
this is a stretch.
Yeah.
But that's all you need in the audience. Like, okay, they took a note that this is very fucking risky, even in this universe where everybody's badass and constantly, like, conversing in one-liners.
Right.
I love that's also pretty cool joke in one of the Austin Powers movies when they're time traveling and somebody starts to ask questions about, you know, like, time paradox and stuff like that, and their response is like,
"I suggest you don't worry about this sort of thing and just enjoy yourself."
Right, then they turn to the camera like,
"That goes for you all too."
But yeah, that's something else I was going to bring up, was that even it doesn't have to be a fantasy movie for us to need to know the rules. Like, or even an action movie for us to need to know the rules. That's a good point. Like, the way people speak is a rule that we need to know. Mm-hmm. Do they speak in one-liners? Do they sound like someone wrote a script for them? Or do they sound conversational and casual and natural?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's something we learn in Act One as well.
Yeah. And let me grab the moment.
Please.
That's why I hate Nolan's Batman movies. Because he creates a universe that it's supposed to be, you know, so raw and serious and realistic.
Uh-huh.
And then a billionaire dude appears in a latex bat suit and is just like, "What the fuck, dude?"
Well, good job. We just lost our whole film bro demographic.
I don't give a shit. Like, I want to lose them. Inception, even worse. Like, that's the same.
You're like, while we're at it.
While we're at it, yeah. Inception versus Ghostbusters. Like, both stories are equally deep. They're just entertaining movies about bullshit science.
Mm-hmm.
But one of them, Ghostbuster, is full of these almost comic book style characters. Everybody's funny. Everybody's goofy. Everybody's keep saying ridiculous shit. And also they use very good fake science, like, you know, like ectoplasma and, you know, like there's a lot of like fake science bullshit in there.
I have kind of a similar thing for in terms of what the movie is sort of suggesting you feel about a character versus what me personally I am feeling, and how those things are in conflict can definitely cause me to dislike a movie, even if they're technically not doing anything wrong. It's just the worldview that I have a problem with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how would you define the worldview? Like, how is it different from the universe?
The worldview is like the ideology of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
The universe is like the details.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Okay. So the worldview is more like the message of the film?
Yes.
Or like what characters the film values?
Yes.
What is the character that the movie sets up
the worldview,
as their hero?
The worldview is the part that you can relate to, or that you are supposed to relate to, or be able to apply to your own life.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the universe is all the...
Those are just the basic
That's
rules.
The metaphor that builds around the message, you know?
Yeah.
This is like that, that's like that, you know, here, that's the whole metaphor that's being created around the message. Okay. But even if it takes place in our world, we need to know the rules and probably some backstory and motivation, etc. At least enough to give us that meaning we need to drive the plot forward. So like you were saying, like the, you know, there's situations where it's not a fantasy movie necessarily, but you still need to know what the rules are. And actually, there's a lot of information that we can do without or get to later on in the movie. But what we need, and this is kind of the eventual conclusion I came to, is the meaning, the opposing worldviews. That is what you need to get to early on in the movie, not necessarily all the details. Actually, we can leave a lot of exposition for later, as movies often do. They don't give us all the information up front. And that's okay to do, actually. It's actually kind of a good idea sometimes. But anyway, just to take an example, in Rambo.
I didn't come here to rescue Rambo from you. I came here to rescue you from him.
It only takes a couple of minutes to learn that he's a Vietnam vet.
She meant First Blood.
First Blood. Who is now a drifter. Sir, what other Rambo would I be talking about? Like, well, the one where he goes to Russia and, like,
no,
fights the communists?
It's just a whole thing, because the first movie is called First Blood.
Right. It's
the
a
second,
whole thing.
Yeah, and the second movie is Rambo 2, but shouldn't be Rambo 1, First Blood 2. You know, yeah. It's like...
You're representing the nerds here, and I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
Someone has to.
Yeah.
So... Yeah, in Rambo, it only takes a couple, in First Blood, it only takes a couple minutes to learn that he's a Vietnam vet who's now a drifter, searching for old Vietnam buddies, whatever, and he's not having any success. A little while later, we learn that he was taken as a prisoner of war and tortured and has PTSD from that. And then after Act One, we learn that he's a Green Beret and is, like, you know, America's most dangerous killing machine, or whatever you want, whatever he is.
In Vietnam, his job was to dispose of enemy personnel. To kill. Period. Win by attrition.
So we learn all this through visual cues, characters giving each other this info in dialogue, and some very quick flashbacks. And we get as much information as we need in Act One to start to understand what the opposing worldviews and the meaning of the film are. We don't need to know he's a Green Beret yet. It's not important. I mean, it becomes important, but we don't really need to know that information yet.
Yeah.
One of the trickiest ways of dealing with exposition is voiceover, which is what I want to talk about in this episode. Mm-hmm. Getting it right is a real art. In my opinion, you're lucky if it's okay, but it's definitely risky. It can definitely be bad or boring or cheesy very easily, and it's rarely really good. But there's a huge variation in voiceover that I want to touch on briefly just to start to open the topic up. There's like...
Just before you say anything, let me, you know, like...
Please.
Give a short rant. Yes. That's something I hate. When people just decide that voiceover is cheating or bad, and they just think any movie with voiceover is just lazy or poorly made. So I'm really glad that you're highlighting some, you know, some examples when the voiceover is actually great.
Yes.
I like voiceovers when they're done well, but also I know it's very often cheesy and it's treating the audience like idiots.
Right. So there's, I don't know if there's like a word for this with voiceovers. It's called, with music, it's called diegetic when it's music that's in the world of the movie. Mm-hmm. It's not like the background music. It's like there's a radio on in the room. Mm-hmm. So whatever, let's call it diegetic voiceover. Mm-hmm. So there's times when it's, you know, actually being spoken to someone in the world of the movie. Mm-hmm. Double Indemnity would be a good example of that. The main character, Walter, speaks his confession to his coworker, Keyes, into a voice recorder, which becomes the voiceover of the whole movie. So technically, it's dialogue and a voiceover. Singing in the Rain is another where the voiceover is also technically dialogue. And in that case, it's only in Act One when the characters first introduce. A famous movie star played by Gene Kelly is telling a reporter how he rose to fame with his motto, always dignity. And that's like juxtaposed over what we see, which is how undignified his rise to fame really was. In that case, the voiceover is indirectly giving us information, telling us about the main character, telling us that he's kind of a ham, that... Like show business and Hollywood is all about, like how it's about presenting a false version of yourself, which all comes up later. But what the voiceover isn't doing is telling us true facts about the character that we can take at face value. And that's kind of the whole joke. So that's another question. Is the voiceover reliable? Is it giving us true information? Also, are they speaking to us, the audience? Is that sort of like that diegetic thing? Like, does that make sense in any way? In other words, like, are we a character? You know, like, why are they speaking to us? And are they trying to convince us of something or document something? You pointed out in a movie we watched recently that the character was actually dead when he was giving the voiceover. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Do you remember what movie it was?
I don't remember. What movie was that?
It was Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was so weird. Yeah, we were hearing this voiceover and it turns out, yeah, like, is this a dead person? Who's like, yeah, like.
Yeah, because they show his body floating there in the water. Mm-hmm. And then his voice is still like, so I was dead. You're like, okay.
Yeah. It just hit me towards the end of the movie. Like, wait a minute. So he died. Who's telling the story with his voice? Is he telling the story from grave?
But that's funny.
That's typically the situation when it's, you know, like a journal of a detective or like, you know, or like somebody's telling a story in a bar or something like that. But I don't mind more abstract voiceovers. Sometimes it's just a very independent narrator who just happens to know everything, like God.
Right.
Or it's kind of like a mix of that in the Big Lebowski.
I was going to bring up the Big Lebowski.
Okay.
No, that's it.
He knows everything. He even knows the motivations and the feelings of the characters that even themselves are not aware of, which is definitely a type of voiceover. when it's not a character, but just an independent narrator who knows everything, kind of the god of that universe. What's weird about the Lebowski, that that guy just appears.
Right. He just appears at some point and breaks the fourth wall.
Yeah.
And actually, same thing with The Muppets Christmas Carol. But with that, the narrator, who is Gonzo and Rizzo the Rat, are directly narrating and telling you and breaking the fourth wall the entire time from beginning to end, pretty much. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of interesting, too.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like this godlike, they kind of, but in that they also like do have physical restrictions, like they have to physically follow him around and they have a hard time doing that.
Yeah.
So they can't keep up with him the whole time.
Yeah, it's really funny. Also, yeah, just back to the, back to Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
Like they did the exact same thing in American Beauty. And I'm not necessarily, I think there are parts in that voiceover that I really like, but also think the movie might be stronger without voiceover. Mm. But one thing they did well is that the same thing happens there, that the person who's narrating the story dies at the end. Even stating it, you know, like 2 months later, I'm going to be dead or something like that.
It is funny that we find it weird that they're narrating when they're dead, considering that when they're narrating and they're alive, it still doesn't make any sense.
It still doesn't make any sense.
Like, yeah. who are they talking to?
I mean, it creates a situation that you and the main character are in a bar or something and he's telling you the story instead of you watching the film. That's, I think that's the vibe they're trying to create with most narrations.
Yeah, some.
Or when there's like an independent narrator who's not even part of the story. That's really just like old school storytelling. It's the descriptive parts of the book.
Right. Well, that's what I was thinking. Like, I kind of briefly looked to see how long ago there started being first-person novels. Just because I was, thinking about this and like...
Yeah.
It's at least 1700s. Could be way older. I don't know. But I wonder when they stopped feeling the need to justify that they were like... Because the first one I found was Gulliver's Travels. And I don't know. I don't remember. I think I might have read part of it. But I think... It might be set up more like, here's an account of my journey that I'm recording so that we will always have it, you know, as opposed to, you don't need to do that with a narration and a voiceover today.
Yeah.
You don't have to explain, I'm going to say all this to you so that you remember and, you know.
Yeah.
Because then also you have to explain why there's a movie.
Yeah.
You know. And who's controlling the movie if you're controlling the voiceover?
Yeah.
Are you directing the movie?
Yeah. Something that happens very often, like in Palmetto. Like the main character is also narrating the story. And that's something that happens in a lot of movies, that towards the end, it turns out that he starts typing the story. Like he's going to write the story and it's going to turn into... It's going to turn into a novel or something, and you're just listening to that, or you're listening him reading the draft version of his book.
Yeah, that's when it becomes that kind of diegetic thing where like, oh, the voiceover exists in this movie, although then they're writing whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Still weird.
Still weird, but it's funny how we've accepted that it's just... normal and fine. This is not a recording of what's happening. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's interesting to think about. I mean, some voiceovers are just the character's inner monologue at that moment. Also, where they're just like, should I do this or this? You know?
Yeah.
It's just like a totally different type.
Oh, also a good example for this, Stranger Than Fiction. Have you seen that?
No.
Like, it turns out in Act One, like that's basically like all that happens in Act One, that there's a narrator, Emma Thompson. She's narrating the life of the main character. And it turns out that the main character can hear it. And he freaks out. Like that's the main conflict, that somebody's narrating his life. Like he's writing a story about him and he can hear it. I think that's good. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah. That's a good take on
it's
the voice.
It's not Charlie Kaufman, but sounds like something he would write.
It does, yeah.
And I think it's a pretty entertaining movie.
Yeah. We should check it out.
Yeah. Also, Casino is the other one I wanted to mention.
Yeah.
Because Casino feels like, and that's also a type of voiceover that only happens in the beginning of the movie. Like, it just speeds up Act One by giving you some information like, hey, these guys are doing this and it's a mob and, you know, like, and they're setting up casinos. And it's so weird because in Casino, the style of voiceover feels like you're only going to hear it in Act One as a setup, but it's keep going and it never stops. And I remember it was weird, but also it's very entertaining and it's very insightful. And also, I think De Niro starts the narration, but at some point Joe Pesci takes over. Like, they're both narrating the story and they're both just talking about like you're watching the movie with them and they're just telling you what's happening. They're just giving you additional information, staying in character. And I think it's very entertaining, but I also remember seeing it shortly after it came out. It felt weird because it really felt like it's supposed to be that voiceover that only happens at the beginning of the movie and it just keep going. And it felt like, wait, it's been an hour. Are we still just setting up the foundations of this movie? What the fuck is going on? And then you realize like, oh no, it's just, this movie is going to be narrated. Like, half of the movie is narration.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk about Goodfellas too. And that's the same thing, is that it's pretty much narrated throughout the whole movie. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, there's probably more at the beginning, but once the break between the voiceover and the actual plot action is pretty seamless. Like, it happens in the same scene when the movie starts developing without the voiceover controlling the development of the action.
Mm-hmm.
Up until then, it's following along with you.
Mm-hmm.
Then it starts to develop without it. But then it still comes back.
Yeah. Oh, and I think some parts of Casino are very good examples of why I disagree with people who always say it, like, don't say it, show it. Like, voiceover is wrong all the time. And in any situation or any case. And there are situations when Joe Pesci, for example, is narrating something that you also see on screen. You know what's going on. You follow it. But Joe Pesci adds to the story is using the proper slang, the proper like Italian mobster terminology, and it just keeps you in the mood. It's more like it's the style and the mood that he provides with the voiceover, because otherwise you would just see this, you know, you would just see a bunch of guys from really far away approaching a car and stuff like that, and you wouldn't feel as involved in it. And the narration is not giving you additional information. It's just using the right words so you stay in this Italian mob universe.
This is exactly what I'm going to talk about with Goodfellas. Well, we'll come back to Goodfellas.
Okay. Are you going to mention Blade Runner?
No. You want to mention it? Go for it.
Okay. So actually, I want to rewatch multiple versions of Blade Runner. I have a version with multiple audio tracks, but I'm not sure it's gonna work. But you know, like Blade Runner originally, they didn't wanna use voiceover. And in the theatrical version, I think there's voiceover.
I can't keep them straight.
I don't know. They're like 8 different versions of that movie. But yeah, so yeah. And the same like pressure from the studio happened in Blade Runner, but there's a version with voiceover. And that's the first theatrical version. But then when they released it on VHS or whatever, like, they already removed the voiceover. And that might be the only difference between those two versions. But then it got re-edited and it got restored and, you know.
Yeah. And that's kind of different, too, because by now the most people who have seen it have seen the one probably without the narration.
Yeah. But yeah. I would love to rewatch the theatrical version and see how bad the voiceover is.
You know, it works though, because it's like film noir, neo-noir. Yes,
Yes, whatever. Actually, yeah, I forgot it. But yeah, I was going to say, since it's neo-noir and narration is such a big part of film noir, it probably adds a lot to the vibe. That's partially, yeah, that's also why I want to watch that particular theatrical version.
I've seen it with the narration.
With the narration?
It's kind of fun because of the noir thing.
I mean, it might be the most entertaining version of that movie.
And because it's Harrison Ford. And, you're on board for Harrison, more Harrison Ford is just better all the time. So.
I agree.
That's the main reason it works, to be fair.
But yeah, did you mention any examples when we just, it's not something that goes through the movie. We can just hear, it's more like a comedic technique that we can hear the thoughts of the characters.
Well, let me go to the next thing, because I think this might help with that. So there are also situations, of course, where the character giving the voiceover breaks the fourth wall. I tend to really dislike this technique, and I was trying to think of why I dislike it. I think it's because characters who do this tend to be very self-confident, and I guess this is supposed to show that they're like in control of the whole narrative. And the tone is usually very like snarky and tongue-in-cheek. And it's fine for a character to be like that. But I think the movie thinks that we like that character because of that. And I don't like characters like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what the issue is. We're supposed to find it like charming and cute when they do that and like them more. And it does not have that effect on me.
Mm-hmm.
Like Ferris Bueller. Or in The Big Short.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. It's not charming. It's annoying. To me.
I mean, Ferris Bueller is fucking annoying.
Yeah.
And ladies and gentlemen, that movie is bullshit neoliberal propaganda. Stop treating it as a cult movie.
What is?
Ferris Bueller.
Oh.
Horrible. Horrible, like, fucking Reaganomics. Fuck that movie.
It's been a long time.
And people remember it like, oh, it's so cute. It's a cult classic. No, it's one of the most neoliberal bullshit movies I've ever seen. And the fact that it's charming for people only making it worse.
Yeah, it's not very culty.
Like, if something is propaganda but shitty, that's fine. But if it's charming, it means it's even more effective, which makes it even more problematic. So yeah, fuck Ferris Bueller. But people also hate the character from High Fidelity.
Oh, I think I turned that movie off because I watched the beginning and I found them so annoying.
Yeah, I don't blame you for that. I personally like that movie, but also I saw it dubbed in Hungarian and it might work so much better. Like,
but, you know, they can also have merit for different reasons.
But I think
it could be like a risky business situation where you're like,
mm-hmm.
Oh, this is satire, and it's remarking on this type of person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But in Ferris Bueller, you're clearly supposed to like him.
Yeah,
you're not supposed to find him.
Yeah.
He is a hero in that.
Yeah. Yeah, and not even an accidental satire like... Risky Business.
Yeah. But you know who can break the fourth wall and get away with it?
Hmm?
Michael Caine.
Oh, yes. Yes, Michael Caine can always break the wall.
Because we recently watched Alfie.
Yeah.
And...
Okay, let's not do this because we're not going to be able to... We're so bad at my... You know, our Michael Caine is so weak that we're not going to use any of these parts because we're trying to imitate his voice. So yeah, Michael Caine...
Speak for yourself, I'm editing.
Okay, well, you can be Michael Caine. You can't be Michael Caine.
You sound like angry Michael Caine.
Because sometimes he's angry.
That's good.
And when he's angry, he's a lot louder.
I think, yeah.
Was that good?
I think you can only do angry Michael Caine.
Okay, so I can't really do that.
Yeah.
The upset Michael Caine. But the loud Michael Caine. I might be good at that. And that might be enough. I'm just going to be pissed, Michael Caine. In it. So,
It's amazing how much better you are at pissed about cocaine.
I'm usually better at pissed things.
On that note, but to name a fourth wall breaker that I do like, Alvy Singer and Annie Hall.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because he's neurotic and self-deprecating,
mm-hmm.
he's not cocky like these other fourth wall people.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually do like him. So it doesn't always have to go hand in hand with this like cocky, like,
yeah,
let me tell you how it's going to be kind of attitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the fact that it's more like a neurotic thing. Because if you think about it, it works so much better. It's so much more related to neurosis. Like, mm-hmm. it's more like a neurotic attitude to constantly commenting on your life and thinking about what you're doing right now. Like that hyper self-awareness.
Right.
That's so much more related to a neurotic mindset than a badass mindset. I mean, another thing in Annie Hall that's cool, that it even starts with him talking to the audience in a studio.
Yeah.
It's not even like, sometimes he breaks the fourth wall, but also the movie starts with him talking directly to the camera with some blank background, like yeah. he's being interviewed.
Yeah. Right. Which, and that's never explained.
And it's never explained. Yeah. It's just shit like that happens. Sometimes they break the fourth wall. Most of the times they don't. They use subtitles.
Yeah, which the subtitle part.
One of my favorite gags in the movie.
Right.
When they're subtitling their inner monologue, where they're having this very superficial small talk.
Yeah.
And both incredibly self-aware and worried about yeah. what the other person thinks.
Yeah. And that just further, like, like that backs up the idea that it's a neurotic,
mm-hmm.
you know, the voice is a neurotic voice. It's a self-aware,
mm-hmm.
overly self-aware voice, not a yeah. self-confident voice.
Mm-hmm.
Self-critical voice. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Another example, but it's not in Act 2, is Welcome to the Middle of the Act Film. One. I mean, it's not in Act 1, is Welcome to the Middle of the Film in The Meaning of Life.
I don't remember that, but that's funny.
Like,
Welcome to the Middle of the Film.
You know, like a person in like some tribal African person, like walking towards the camera and zips himself in half. And I think it's Terry Gilliam underneath him.
Of course.
Approaching the camera. And he just says, welcome to the middle of the film. And they just comment on that, you know, like even though the film is called The Meaning of Life, we watched the first half of the film and we haven't found out anything about the meaning of life yet. Let's just...
Okay, I'm just going to quickly sum up the last few types
mm-hmm.
very quickly. It can be like radio or TV, like in Citizen Kane. It can be an unidentified, like journalistic, like totally non-character, like in Casablanca. And then we already mentioned Big Lebowski,
mm-hmm.
Kind of godlike character that's mm-hmm. just kind of a witness,
yeah.
you could say.
I mean, not even necessarily, like sometimes it's a witness, but sometimes they really know everything. They're mm-hmm. more like a witness. They're more like a god.
More like God, yeah.
Because that's they true. Even know the motivations of the characters, or they yeah. even know they know a lot more about the characters than they're aware of.
Right, that's true.
So I think it's different than from the journal kind of like, yeah, like somebody saw it.
Yeah, or like the kind of classic, like the movie, the camera starts to go to the like right, you know, pan to the right, and then then the narrator's like, wait, no, come back here, or something like that. You
oh,
know?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
kind of like a classic voiceover moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like they are losing control of the camera
yeah.
and where it's pointing.
Yeah.
Or Wayne's World.
Yes. Another great example.
Where, we're keeping it classy around here.
Yeah.
I love Wayne's World.
you know, Citizen Kane, Wayne's World. You know, like I love that little bridge between those two movies.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's all the same in the end. Mm-hmm. So I kind of hit a wall when I was trying to write about voiceover for this because I watched Goodfellas, remembering that it has an awesome voiceover and thinking that I would come to a few conclusions about voiceover. One, that voiceover is good if it's telling you something essential that you can't learn any other way. And two, that it's good if it's like economical, as in it doesn't repeat the same information or information that you already know or that you can just see with your own eyes. But neither of those are really true in Goodfellas. And yet I really enjoy that voiceover and I think of it as essential to the movie. Even though basically all of the information that we get could have been delivered some other way. So as in like the exposition could have been shown to us rather than him talking over it. The whole thing is kind of in montage and you could just watch it rather than hearing him explain it all.
But isn't it similar then to what I said about Casino, that it's kind of the addition, the added information is not literal information, but more like putting you in a certain mood and providing a certain style by using the right type of terminology and slang and lingo?
Exactly. Like it's an aesthetic thing. It's kind of like the set of the movie, mm-hmm. Or the music. Or something like that. Like it's genuinely funny, it's stylish, it's dynamic and fast paced, which has that like frenetic energy that the whole film has. It repeats itself because it's conversational and casual sounding. So even though it's not economical, it's natural sounding. Sounds like you're in a bar with the person, kind of like what you were saying. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, his accent, the lingo he uses.
I think it's different. You know, if it's a movie about suburbia, then a voiceover is a lot more questionable. And they would have to do a little more to earn why you need a voiceover there. But if it's about if it's a movie about a very specific subculture that most people hardly ever interact with, and they have so many interesting slangs and a lot of style around it, the way they talk to each other is partially how you recognize that, oh, they're mobsters, not just, you know, trashy Jersey people.
Wow, just had to sneak that in there, huh? Mm-hmm. I'm from New Jersey, for the listeners who don't know. Because yeah. It's not obvious from my heavy accent.
No. So, I think if it's about an underground subculture, then I think it makes perfect sense to use voiceover to make it more personal.
Yeah, it's a good point. I see what you're saying. I mean, especially when you consider when Goodfellas came out and how the culture hadn't been so, you know, like soaked in this gangster mythology at that point. But then again, like, that generation grew up with film noir, so, you know, they're pretty familiar with it from that.
Yeah, but to me, that's a very different, or a slightly different thing, though.
Yeah, but I think, like, the lingo, the New York underworld, the Italians, I know it's not exactly the same, but mm-hmm. I'm just kind of playing both sides here. Mm-hmm. But I see what you're, mm-hmm. I see what you're saying. Yeah. And we're not disagreeing anyway. Yeah. I am agreeing that that's a major part of what makes it work.
All I'm saying is that, you know, like
style. Or justifies it, I should say.
All I'm saying is style is a very essential part of mobster movies. So mm-hmm. if any element is supporting the style, it's already earned to me. Mm-hmm. Also, there's another thing. Scorsese probably uses voiceover because he very often tells you stories about horrible people, and it's also a way to make it still makes you feel personally related to the characters, if you wouldn't have the voiceover, if you wouldn't feel like this person is talking directly to you and telling their personal story and experience, then you would just see these horrible mobsters and you wish they all would just end up in jail as soon as possible. Without the voiceover, it would be just this very objective point of view of showing horrible people doing crime and killing each other and killing innocent people.
Yeah, I didn't think of that exactly, but that's also a very good point. But it is a lot closer to that, what I landed on.
Cool.
So without any voiceover, you are kind of watching a film about a person getting dragged into this underworld. Someone who is kind of like succumbing to this world of power and corruption. And you would essentially think you're watching a tragedy, which is kind of what you were getting at. Like it's really dark. It seems bad. It seems not okay what's happening. And you know that things are not going to work out. Or you feel that things are not going to work out. But what he's basically communicating to us in the voiceover is, like, I don't have any regrets about what I did. Because, like, considering his circumstances and how little prospects he had in life, everything he did actually makes perfect sense. And for the most part, it worked out pretty well for him, which is, like, kind of the joke of the whole movie. That no matter what you think, being a gangster is still a better deal than being just an average schmuck. And it's kind of that kind of dark, like dark take on lower class life that makes the movie more awesome, I think. Like that in spite of everything terrible about it, being a gangster is still way better than just being an average American. Actually, he does achieve the American dream. Having a better life than his parents had and having more opportunity than they had. Whereas the average American probably won't achieve the American dream.
Yeah, that's a good one. And also, I'm very glad to use the word schmuck.
Thank you.
Very appropriate.
Thank you. And then at the end, you know, he has to become just an average schmuck. He has to go into witness protection.
So we do spoilers now? I thought we're not doing
spoilers. I just said spoiler. Oh, if you say it, it's okay. So, or I've decided it's okay.
Yeah.
That's the rule.
I just...
That's been the rule for every podcast I listen to about movies.
Yeah, it's just... You know, like I was struggling, like trying to describe the situation in Blade Runner without a spoiler, and it was not easy. You made me rephrase it so it won't be a spoiler, and now it's just like, spoiler, he will end up being an average person. Like, that's it? But sure, I'll do that in the future. Just gonna scream spoiler.
Yeah, just give them a minute to panic. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you can spoil it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he goes into witness protection or whatever it is and ends up just like living in the suburbs in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. Having a boring suburban life.
Which is also kind of sad.
Yeah, it's extremely sad. It is a tragedy. It's the worst case scenario for him. Mm-hmm. It's exactly what he was trying to avoid. Because like in the beginning, during the voiceover, he talks about how his, you know, his dad is like struggling to support them. He's pissed off all the time. He's like, just, you know, wants his kid to do well in school because he thinks that's the only way that they could possibly get out of this. But I don't think that like satirical part of the story like really comes across without the voiceover, especially the humor. Mm-hmm. Kind of like what you were saying. Like it's a really dark movie about really fucked up people if without the voiceover. And the tone is interesting too, the way that he he's not trying to like convince you of anything, but it is kind of like he's talking to you as the audience as like, no, like this was good. Like, you know, his tone is sort of like, he's not defensive. He's just like he's just kind of celebrating the lifestyle, mm-hmm. I guess. He's sort of like, no, it was great, actually. Mm-hmm. You might not know that, mm-hmm. but, you know, we were on top of the world.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
They're hurting themselves. They're hurting each other. And most importantly, they're hurting innocent people constantly. And it wouldn't make any sense if in the meantime, they wouldn't feel like they're on, you know, like they're having the best time of their life.
Yeah. It's like, don't not do it because it's not going to be awesome. Mm-hmm. Don't do it because you'd be killing innocent people. Or, yeah, like,
yeah, and
stealing money.
And fueling corruption. Yeah. And, yeah.
Like, but the more we talk about it, I'm like, yeah, who, you know, you're killing, you're actually killing guilty people and stealing from the rich. So, like, fuck them.
Well, you know, if you already lost all your hope in civilization, then sure, just let the mob rule the world.
Yeah. I mean, the risk he's facing is, like, jail time, they make a pretty big point of, is not that bad. Actually, early on in the movie, he gets arrested, but he gets out mm-hmm. because they're so well connected. Mm-hmm. And then the same is true when he goes to jail later in the movie. They like, that's the whole scene where they're like cooking and stuff, you mm-hmm. know, in the jail. And it's like great. They're having mm-hmm. a great time. So like, yeah. So that's not a risk. And then like the real risk is like, if you don't, you know, if you don't do exactly what you should be doing, when you don't keep your mouth shut and you're not a rat, then you're, you know, like people, you won't get killed, you know, that's the risk, I mm-hmm. think. It's kind of a strange, that's kind of like the American dream too, you know, this idea that as long as you do everything right, you're going to be rewarded.
By everything right, you mean according to the rules?
According to the rules.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't be a rat. That's the rules mm-hmm. in their world.
Yeah, and you know, don't be in the way of the bullet either. That's probably a good idea.
True.
Which is another layer that kind of justifies the voiceover to me. Nobody speaks. Nobody rats in that except the one person that the movie is about.
Yeah, that's kind of a fun extra layer to think about. It's like the voice during the voiceover, they are ratting. The whole thing is them ratting.
Yeah, pretty much.
They're exposing everyone, everything they do.
Yeah, it's like the ultimate ratting. Nobody rats more than the voiceover.
No one rats more than Scorsese. Thanks for listening to Postscript. The music for this episode was created by my brother, Graham. If you want to reach any of us, you can email postscriptcast@gmail.com.
I'm David, the boyfriend.